Hello, I'm Jill Trebilcock, and I'm broadcasting from We Raw Radio, Truth Broadcasting Network. Scotland is free, Cancel the Cabal, and People's
People's Internet.
Internet Radio.
That's right.
And thanks to my producer, Stephen Roberts. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome, Jill.
And today, Stephen, we have Stuart Twemlow again.
Yes, this is number six in a series of interviews.
Right, and Stuart is a Renchi master, a martial artist, a psychoanalyst, a psychiatrist, and you'll notice I've got ink on my tongue because I put my pen in my mouth, and also a bit of an expert on bullying in schools. And Stuart, you were involved in some ways with the Columbine shootings.
Yes.
And today we want to ask you to talk about adolescents who kill. Would you like? Yeah. So, Stuart, it's pretty unusual for adolescents to kill, isn't it?
Yes.
So,
Actually, pretty unusual for anybody to kill.
yeah, that's true. So something really terrible must happen for you to want to kill, or you must be pretty desperate.
You must be, and also you must have a way of killing. That's pretty easy to do.
That's true. Yeah, because
Say, for
especially when.
example, your country, Australia. How many school shootings have you had?
None.
There you have the answer.
Oh, so you're going to gun control now?
No.
No? What do you mean then?
What I mean is, your children don't have easy access, similar to France. Most of the murders in France are with knives.
Right.
In America, you can buy a bazooka legally. You know what that is?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, they're big guns. Boom, boom.
Yeah, if you hit a deer with a bazooka, there wouldn't be much deer left.
Not a good thing. Well, look, we did say in another interview that it wasn't really the guns that were the problem; it was the people that was the that were the problem. And you can poison people. I mean, there are other ways you can kill people.
Yeah, but why would you want to kill people by other ways if you have a Saturday night special for $50 that would kill people easily?
Okay, so the thing is, like in the Columbine shootings, there's obviously like it's quite easy to access all of the tapes, and those boys, Harris and Klebold, were, or is that how you say his name? Was it Klebold
Oh,
or
Klebold.
Klebold? Were both like they built up this sort of incredible rage. This absolutely phenomenal rage, particularly Eric Harris.
They both did it together. Yeah. Let me tell you somebody. It sounds incredible, but have you listened to Osama bin Laden?
Not really. Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
And you've listened to recently the Taliban, particularly Afghan Taliban.
No, I'm one of these people who has decided to go on radio that does not listen to does not have a television or read the newspapers. Okay, because I'm sort of more interested in exploring the psychological things, and it's not a very good sociological approach, I know, but no, I don't know the latest by the Taliban. What's happening?
Well, the issue here is that when you become focused on a particular ideology, as did Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, or Osama bin Laden, or the current Taliban leaders in both Pakistan, who are more extreme, and Afghanistan, who are showing some interest in collaborating, what you get is a idea that just because you are not Muslim, you deserve to be killed. Now, the equivalent of that for Eric Harris was, if you are a fuckhead, you deserve to be killed.
So how do you become a fuckhead?
The goal is to, for the, a fuckhead is a person,
According to Eric Harris.
and Dylan Klebold to some extent, although Dylan Klebold was less involved. A fuckhead is a person who plays karate, is old, has religious beliefs, drives too slowly, drives a truck too slowly, belongs to any sort of organization that makes them nice people, like Lions Club or Rotary. In other words, there isn't a single type of person in the world that would not fit into the idea of fuckhead. They're all people
But
that are not like Harrison Klebold, particularly Harris. And similar to Osama bin Laden, if you are not Muslim, you need to be dead.
Yeah, well, I don't understand the psychological terminology of fixation. But for me, I call that...
terminology there, Jill.
No, I've just brought in the word fixation because it seems to me when I was looking at it, I thought he's like developed a fixation. Would that be a correct term to... is that what psychiatrists mean when they say fixation?
No.
No, it's not. So fixation is a different thing. So it's an obsession then, is it?
It's an obsession, but the difference between an obsession and a fixation is that it's not personal.
Fixation is personal.
Osama bin Laden was a holy man who just felt you and Steve should die.
Yeah, with some holiness.
Sure. He would give you the last rites. He would... not in any way be against you. Just because you're Christians or whatever you are, or you're not Muslims, and so unfortunately, and he would cry about you after you died, you'd be dead.
But you have to be killed because you've been labeled evil.
Eric Harris, fuckheads were the same. They wanted to purify the world of fuckheads.
Well, look, Stuart, from the research that I've done, and... it's just quite controversial, but it seems to me that they kept saying that their motive for the murder was the January incident. And the January incident was when he was arrested by a policeman. And then he's drawn a picture, which I might be able to bring into Skype here to show you, in which he has a picture of the January incident, the police, and there was a there was a file, which is all here, in which he says that he draws a picture of the crime scene of the January incident. And I'm wondering why the January incident wasn't investigated more, because he's saying that it all came back. They want to pay the cops back for the January incident. And the stuff that I've read that's available on the internet now is saying that the January incident, he was raped by the policeman who arrested him. They also say, so I'm thinking, and then there's a tape of him being accused in the school by students saying something like, Eric got jacked up the arse. And Eric's there going, I didn't, not really, like, you know, he didn't say I wasn't jacked up the arse. He's sort of sitting there looking really angsty. And I looked at it and I thought, that would make a lot of sense. Firstly, why haven't they looked at the January incident? Like, what is so big about the January incident if it's just an arrest, when they'd already been arrested and had contact with the police previously, as far as I know? But anyway, what I'm saying is, if you're raped by a policeman, that'd be enough to make you want to turn against the universe.
Jill, I'm not sure I agree with you.
No, you don't have to. You're not meant to. In fact, it's better if you don't. It makes a more interesting show.
Do you think I didn't know that?
I poked out my tongue. I put green ink on it. Go on.
Okay.
Yeah, go on.
First of all, policemen are always blamed for everything. And that, I don't think blaming a policeman would make one bit of difference to the outcome of Columbine. Policemen were blamed in many, many more ways than what you've just described of a Columbine. But let me say, the probability that Harris was sodomized by the police... I mean, is minimal.
No, I don't think it is at all.
He basically committed a crime that didn't need any of that. I mean, he was caught in a school system. It was crazy. And
well, look,
he went ahead and I haven't come to my punchline yet, my dear.
I'm with you. I might be looking weird, but I'm with you.
Wait before you interrupt me, okay? he lived in the school. It was a disturbed school, very disturbed. His pattern of behavior, according to psychoanalysts, was fully understandable. Now, besides all that, he was discharged from probation by a very experienced probation officer. He knew all of his history 5 days before the attack on the school, as the very best student this officer had ever handled, and whom he thought would do better in the outside world than any other student that he'd ever seen. Mm. See, that would not come from a probation officer who was supervising a child who had been raped by another probation officer. That would not happen.
I've got to disagree. I'm sorry.
You have no evidence of the rape whatsoever, none. And the evidence of this officer.
You don't know what evidence I have, but I'm not saying I do have evidence, but you can't say that I have none.
Well, I can say that very easily. I just said it.
Yeah, you can say it, but it's not necessarily. It's like me saying you don't have any green socks in your house. I haven't looked at all your socks.
Have any what?
Green socks in your house.
Oh, I have several pairs of green socks.
Right. Well, you see, I could tell you you don't because I haven't looked. So you don't know what whether I have evidence.
Let me ask you this. You're not a bastard, are you?
No, but why?
Have you got a birth certificate?
Yes.
Let me see it.
I can't.
Well, would you be okay if I called you a bastard till you showed it to me?
Yeah.
What sort of argument is very simple junior high school debating? I'm not going to get into it.
I don't want to debate with you, but you've just said that I've seen no evidence. I have no evidence. And I'm saying I've seen something that makes me very suspicious. But this isn't the topic for today.
Unless if a cop had raped a young man, that goes on all the time in the United States. I have nothing against cops.
Well,
I do have things against cops doing it. I do know it goes on. But in this instance, I think it's highly improbable.
Okay, well, look, can I just, I get you, and what you're saying is that in this instance you think it's highly improbable and you don't want to go on about that, and I agree. My reason, and I do agree, I'm going to follow where you lead me, but just to clear up from my point of view, because I want to be understood by you and by people who are listening. My reason for going on about this is I'm saying there's some trauma there, and let's just move from that. Like, to want to kill a lot of people like that and to sort of disassociate from those other aspects of yourself and turn into a cold-blooded murderer, something really big must have happened. And he's...
Certainly.
Yeah. So let's just go from there. We won't say whether it was the January incident or not, but we'll just say something terrible happens to these people. So somehow society and family and experiences create killers and children with such incredible rage. And from the notes and the letters and the PowerPoint and the information that you've sent me, you can talk on. I've forgotten. It's socially constructed in a lot of ways, I can see.
Socially constructed. And let me take this a bit further. There is a possibility that particular individuals are very predisposed to violent action as a result of serious mental problems, and by that I'm talking about brain disorders. They're called psychopaths, and they have disorders in their brain that prevent them from understanding normal human feelings and give them an inability to be understanding and empathic. Instead, they're very often callous. They're rare, less than 0.5% of the population. But if they're in the school, I suggest principals get them out of the school as quickly as possible, because not only are they not good for their school, but the school is no good for them. What percent of the population is like this in schools? I would say a maximum of 1%, which means that in a very small school, there might be two. In a school of 1,000 kids, there might be as many as 10. You need to watch. Those kids are problematic. The research has not been done to identify them. But what worries me is the majority of law enforcement, including the FBI, which, as you know, I have a very cordial relationship, and the Secret Service, with which I have the same cordial relationship, focus their attention on what they think is the mission-oriented killer. I think that's the silliest concept in the world. Many ways, it's like the FBI chooses the psychopath, the NRA chooses the mentally ill person, gun control chooses guns, the Secret Service chooses behavior. Each chooses what is most popular for their particular viewpoint. An issue that really somebody like me can see, because I don't have any particular one way or the other thing. I'm not a FBI employed person, although I am a consultant to them. I'm not in the Secret Service. I'm not in the NRA. I'm not in the gun control lobby. I'm not in the anti-gun control lobby. I don't have any connection with any of them, except to say this. When you get on your hobby horse, you hurt your cause. This is very complicated question. Now, why do I say that?
You lose your curiosity.
What?
When you lose your curiosity.
Well, the thing is, and I'm going to say it really straight to you, I think you, I, or Stephen could become a school shooter if we were in schools. Under the right socio-cultural conditions. I don't think there's any difference between you and a mission-oriented killer, or me or Steve. It all depends on the circumstances surrounding the killing. And each of the events I looked at in 18 homicides in 18 schools, only one of which was Columbine, were precipitated by very unusual circumstances that involved harassment and bullying of the perpetrators by the victims. I'm not saying that the perpetrators were relieved of guilt for that, but I am saying that did occur. I think there was only one school shooting where that did not occur, and in that instance.
Well, this is exactly why I was back where I was before, why I was thinking about that, and that is the people do have to feel disconnected and isolated emotionally to get that sort of
Absolutely. And see, here's where it happens. When you have a fight with your significant other, you may behave like Eric Harris. You may even think of murder. I'm not asking either you or Steve to admit to this, but I'm simply saying I know you've thought of murder of your closest partner.
I used to plan to kill my father when I was little.
Right. And so here's...
Well, not plan, not a plan, but yeah, I know. Yeah.
Your father, he's still alive. Everything's okay. Now, every time you go into one of those arguments and you feel like, you know, you're coming to a point of explosion, and then everything rocks away, and then you hug each other and kiss each other and maybe you have sex, everything's fine. You've gone from being a mission-oriented shooter to being an ordinary person.
Mm.
Now, what Klebold and Harris did not have was a context in the family to enable him to avoid the changeover from crazy mission-oriented killer that you might have been, like when you thought of killing your father, to an ordinary person who suddenly realized what they were saying was not realistic. If you think on the last time you said that in a rage with your partner, you probably said things you didn't believe, and you probably didn't say things you wished you'd said. And then afterwards you say, why didn't I say those things? And I ask you the question, why didn't you? And I remind you that that state of mind leads to death. What keeps you alive and not dead is that you have a family structure to come back to that loves and takes care of you.
Yeah, well, this is the thing.
People did not have that.
No. They managed to fool their family quite well. He managed to, the family were quite disconnected, and this is what keeps being apparent to me from what I've looked at, is that even if they were raped, because thousands and thousands and millions of people have been raped, the support structure within the school, or to be able to go to somebody and say, I've been abused in whatever way, or I'm upset because I feel undervalued in whatever way, that language, those sort of conversations and the setup for somebody to receive that conversation, or that empathic kind of situation, is not in existence in the school culture or in the family culture.
See, Eric Harris was born into a family, this is guesswork, okay, where he would be 50 IQ points above either his mother or his father. He was brilliant. I think he memorized a Shakespearean play. He had a 4.0 grade point average. In the ninth grade, he had a college scholarship in mathematics. He's brilliant. Klebold was not. Klebold was an ordinary kid who was often depressed, who was existentially disturbed, who didn't become angry until the last few days before the shootings. He was depressed, miserable, and Klebold kept trying to sort of build him up, and he was constantly, life is pointless, life is silly, we should kill ourselves, why don't we commit suicide immediately? Now, all those writings that you saw, I have seen as a psychiatrist in perfectly normal teenagers who wish to kill their parents and everybody else around them.
Mm.
The question is, why did Klebold and Harris do this?
Mm. And the answer is?
I think that the school was completely unable to contain them psychologically. Here's what I mean by containment. I mean manage their pathology, talk through with them their difficulties, manage their idea of fuckheads as a normal adolescent phase, and try and bring Harris down to normal and Klebold up to normal. But by then, each of them had lots of followers. So here's what interested me. One of the reasons, Jill, that I felt that whole thing was crazy. These boys knew nothing about guns. They knew nothing about explosives. They had gone out into the country and fired off guns, and I believe Harris seriously injured his shoulder because he didn't know anything about kickback.
Mm-hmm.
When they went to the school with all these bombs that they wanted to use to blow up the school, not a single one worked. You know why? They had no detonators. They'd learned about that by reading a book called Hell on Earth. Have you ever heard of that book?
I have.
Part of Doom 2. It's a book for children about using video games. So they came to the school with a ton of bombs that were useless. And then they had these weapons that had injured them. And so they went into the school, I mean, literally with all these kids sprayed around the guns, killed all sorts of kids because it's very easy to do that. And then they get sick of it.
And yeah, they only killed 12 people.
Along the way and had a smoke and discuss, what the hell are we doing? It doesn't make any sense. And we're bored. And then they finally said, oh, let's finish it off anyway. So they went into the library and shot a few people, and then they shot themselves. And the thing about it, I'm saying, is these were not trained SWAT men. They were not trained SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets. They were ignorant children who knew nothing about firepower. Now, let me tell you, at the time those first weapons went off, there were 750 policemen in those school grounds. There was a kid hanging out of one of the windows of the school, seriously injured with gunfire, for 3.5 hours.
Why?
Hanging in front of police who were too scared to get the kid. This kid actually survived. It's amazing. He has some brain damage, of course. Our people did not do well. I'm not defending the police. I think they did a terrible job. Never mind raping Harris. They didn't do enough to protect the goddamn school, Jill.
Oh, there's so many areas that didn't protect the school, and that's what we're really sort of interested in, is children who do kill. And, from my point of view, which is obviously you're just going to agree and you probably prefer to say it yourself, but that is the protective elements are just not there, like the relationship with the parents, the relationship with their friends, the acceptance. Like, I'd like to think if I was a boy and I got jacked up the ass, which was the sentence that they used in the video that I saw, if I was a boy and I got jacked up the ass, that I would like, in an ideal world, to be able to go to school and say, I just got jacked up the ass, and my friends would go, oh no, you poor thing, that must be terrible, and talk about it and not be teased about it or bullied about it.
Yeah. And
because, I mean, as there's so few psychopaths in the world, then that means that 90% of the population should be able to say to me, oh, you poor thing, you just got jacked up the ass.
It can't.
Yeah, well...
Why can't they? Because, let me tell you the story again. I think I've told you of the very wealthy CEO who's worth, I think, 20, 30 million. So after the Katrina incident in New Orleans, decided he and his family needed to help people in New Orleans. So he packed them all in the car, all his children, took them out of school, and his wife, and down to New Orleans they went. And he was there to help the people of New Orleans. And the first thing happened, his windshield was shattered with gunfire. And he got out of the car, and he raged at, "I'm here to help you. What are you shooting at me for?" Anyway, to cut a long story short, he eventually backed off. He realized that there's a lot more complex reaction to serious trauma than simply welcoming people who are wanting to be helpful. This guy knew nothing about destructiveness. He'd never studied violence. He didn't understand the sort of things that went on at Columbine High School. He'd never even thought about it. And people that talk about Columbine today are exactly the same. They say, let us put our best foot forward. Let us say that this needs American positivism, part of what we brought from England, where there was a crazy king. My point is, this will not solve anything.
Okay, so you're saying positivism will not solve anything. So what are you saying positivism is?
Well, positivism is a way of thinking about things that says the following. Put your mind in the future, put the past behind you, and if you keep future focused, everything will work out for you. Make use of the bad things that happen to you and try and see what in those bad things you can learn from. Learn from them and move on past the negativity. Always step forward. And my problem with that, it's not that I'm negative in my thinking. I'm saying the negative things that you see don't go away that easily. You have to deal with them.
Yeah, there has to be more presence, being able to sit with your suffering and and be authentic rather than fabricate some mind in the future aspect.
Plus, I remember one important thing about the sort of a sidebar issue, which is grieving. What you have to remember is grieving does you. You don't do grieving.
Mm.
So much as you want to avoid grieving, it'll get you in the end. Unless you allow the grieving to do you.
Yeah.
And my worry is that unless people are willing to deal with negativity, it will destroy them.
Yeah. It's so true.
You should focus on it. I'm just saying, don't deal with it. It will do us. It will hurt us.
Okay, well, that brings up two questions, one of which I can remember, and that is, what's your idea of dealing with it? Because, see, some people think to deal with it, they have to become positive rather than actually experiencing it and watching it.
Absolutely. Now, I would suggest, and I've had that question posed to me many, many times, Jill. I don't think you should join a positive thinking religious group. I think that would be a mistake. I don't think you should join a group that points everything to the positive. I think first you should go and see a psychotherapist who's not oriented to either positive or negative, who will listen to you and see what he or she thinks your problems are. And if the negative piece of it seems to be an important part, deal with it with them. When that's processed, which may not take much time, I would say up to 20 sessions, then go to a support group that is positive and learn lots of things about positive thinking.
But process it first.
Negativity. I don't think that's too much to ask people. What is 20 sessions when you compare it with the hundreds of hours and days you've spent becoming negative? I mean, why not spend 20 hours with a therapist working through the negative and then go on to the positive thinking groups?
Yeah, absolutely. So just sort of go through it, taste it, feel it, look at it, examine it from every possible way that you possibly can, with an empathic friend, because you are an empathic listener, and also a friend that isn't limited in the way that they try and label what you're going through.
Absolutely.
But see it as a natural occurrence of the human psyche. Yeah, and they're very hard friends to find. And wouldn't it be good if we could train it?
Let me say this. In the United States, most people have health insurance. I think they do in Australia. Use your health insurance. Go to a psychotherapist.
Mm.
I suggest psychoanalytically trained therapists.
Yeah.
And the reason I suggest that, Jill, is because they will not tell you to be positive or negative.
Mm.
They leave it up to you to decide that.
Yes.
And that's what I'm suggesting with 20 hours. Mm. I'm not suggesting 20 hours with a friend. I'm suggesting 20 hours with a therapist. That might cost you $2,000 if you had to pay for it, but you might get it covered by your health insurance.
Mm. And you're also sort of hinting that when somebody can hold the space for you, as a well-trained analyst or therapist can do, then the psyche has its own way of knowing its own solutions.
Absolutely. You put it very well. I mean, I'm glad. I mean, I think what you just said was really critical. You're in the right circumstances with the right sort of therapist. He's not trying to push you one way or the other. Your mind will suddenly be able to get itself right tied up, if you like.
Yeah.
It just needs nobody pushing one way or the other.
Mm.
And I think you put it extremely well.
Well, that brings me to thank you, because people talk about, I just wrote this down, closure, you know, and I hate that term closure as opposed to process. You know, it's, and you're talking about processing it rather than aiming for closure, because that's a step away from the authenticity. And it's a goal. It's solution. It's future, or whatever that word was you said before. Positive sort of focus, which, as though there's meant to be a closure. I don't think there is such a thing as closure. I just think, and tell me what you think about this. You just have to process what's happened, and as I said, in that sort of in an authentic relationship with yourself and with an authentic supporter.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with you in terms of closure. Matter of fact, I actually don't like the word at all.
Me either.
There's no closure. All there is an ongoing process that continues forever. You know, 4 o'clock in the morning, this morning, I got up, my wife was watching a movie, and then we stopped. She stopped the movie, and we talked about how her father, who's now been dead for 4 or 5 years, he and I used to talk about a particular issue and how wise I thought that was. And, you know, it was just a process of going on talking about something. My wife has been grieving her parents for years. They were remarkable people. One of the very few couples, by the way, that I thought were happily married. and died within a week of each other, by the way. But I had many, many long talks with her father. And it was like you keep on living the process. She's, you know, getting old, and her sisters are getting old, and she's worried about her age, and I'm worried about mine. And we just talked about, well, hell, you know, I take care of whatever I can whenever I can. That's why I just had a tooth extracted today. Actually, it was a very pleasant experience. It was a guy about my age, and it was a wisdom tooth, so it didn't worry much. And, you know, I had a not unusual experience, and obviously it's not affected my speaking. And this is the process of life, Jill. Yeah. People want closure, but if they want closure, there's no closure.
So the thing is, speaking of closure, we've only got like about not an awful lot of time, and I've got this PowerPoint here that I'm just looking at, and I can't really see how we're going to go through that. We've got 15 minutes. So where would you, have you got, I mean, I can think of something if you give me 20 seconds, but have you got any particular thing that you're interested in to do with this?
Issue of adolescents who threaten homicide.
Exactly.
Well, first of all, I've got a few key issues. One is that it's an American phenomenon. The only other place that I've seen it as serious is Finland. And that's because the Finnish always have guns in their basement because they're afraid of Russian invasion, even though they're a socialist democracy. And they have a high body count school shooting. However, we've consulted with them, and they've changed their laws. So I think the situation there is a whole lot better than it used to be. Why is America this problematic about gun violence?
Actually, Stuart.
Adolescent violence. Yeah, go ahead.
I did a lot of research on this, and one of them was I looked about in Japan. There's been a lot of children in Japan have taken up murdering, surprisingly. Yeah. And they form little. Their choice of weapons is interesting. They don't have guns.
Yeah.
They kill with baseball bats and knives.
Right.
And they basically, this 17-year-old boy did do a school shooting. And anyway, there's an escalation. I've got it written here. There's an escalation in teenage crime attacking all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. They don't all do it because they're failing at school, but they're failing somewhere. Yeah. And this one boy, when he killed himself, he wrote a note. He actually chopped somebody's head off, I think. But anyway, he said, "If I cannot succeed in an orthodox way, at least I can succeed in a criminal world."
Yeah, well, let me just say this, since we have little time left. In the average school in the United States and Japan and Finland, there's a pecking order in adolescence. Adolescents are, first of all, suddenly flooded with estrogens and testosterone. After puberty, they're not like they used to be. Mm. They're trying to grow up into adults. And parents, of course, hate this because they have to be the totems against whom the children try out their various phases, like atheistic or interested in sports or not interested or whatever else that the parents want. And parents often see them as demented. And even Plato in his Republic suggested that in the ideal utopia, adolescents should be put in institutions and returned to their parents when they were 20. And so adolescents have issues. Now, one of the issues is they are very sensitive to the opinions of their peers, far more so than the opinions of parents. And I'm sure you must have, and Steve, you must have also, had the experience of your children wanting to walk behind you or in front of you because they don't want to be seen with you. And that's a common experience of parents. Now, these children are very sensitive to their peer reviews, much more so than to you.
Yep, that's very true.
If you don't like them, it's like a death sentence.
Absolutely.
If you don't understand that, don't see it. It's particularly prominent in mid-adolescence.
Absolutely.
That's when you get the bully victim bystander situation that is normal in most families and normal in most organizations like schools. But it can become fixed. So the bully and the victim adopt fixed roles. And that goes underground. The bystanders know something is wrong, but they can't put their fingers on it. An example would be during the Columbine massacre, I had a boy who came back to live with his father because he went to Columbine, where he wanted to, with his mother, who both of them are divorced. But he so hated the school because of its chronic, severe bullying and because he had the feeling something awful was going to happen there. And six months later, it did.
Right, and that's a very important thing too, because so many people paint it as not having been a difficult school, but it was obviously a difficult school.
It was a very, very difficult school. Every one of the school shootings has occurred in an extremely difficult school. Let me reassure you.
Of course, because the this is back to the thing that you keep saying, and that is that the society and the bystanders construct the climate. That's extremely important. And so in terms of the solutions, that's why people maybe, if we did have, I know you have lots of solutions for that, but children who do have empathic conversations with each other and teach each other empathy. Stephen. Yeah. Yes, Stephen.
I didn't say anything.
They won't get into those sort of issues. I mean, many of these issues can be solved at the school and or parent level. They never need to lead to homicide.
Yeah. If only people feel heard, because that's that disconnection again, that feeling like I don't belong anywhere. Like when your heart is open, then why do you want to kill somebody?
Well, why would an intelligent man like Eric Harris, with a college scholarship, with a 4.0 grade point average, he'd memorized a Shakespearean play, why would he feel so low in self-esteem he had to go and get all the fuckheads out of the world?
Exactly. Something terrible must have happened.
He was not mentally ill, Jill.
No. I don't think he was psychotic.
He was not schizophrenic. He was an average kid.
This is what I like to hear you say, Stuart. And I know you. I know that's a true thing. And the word "fix," where I got it wrong with fixation, but that's what it appeared to me too. He got a fixed idea about revenge. He grew it and grew it and grew it, and he's sort of developed a persona with all of his friends sort of supporting him, and he couldn't back out. And I even imagine him walking around the school going, oh, this is worse than I thought. Oh, well, we're stuffed now. We may as well go through with it.
He ended up with no faith at all on the teachers. I think the final thing that knocked Eric Harris was he couldn't find a single teacher that he respected.
Yeah, and that... Look, Stuart, just to go sideways a little bit, because I've sort of got a bee in my bonnet about this one, but in Japan, they have a reform system. This is just something I'd like to throw in and have your opinion on it. But it's quite ancient and dates from previous times, which seems to be a very empathic way to do it. And that is not to punish, because they are having a lot of murders. And some people are saying, oh, you know, they don't have enough punishment. You know, you can kill somebody in Japan and you just go to reform school. But then I saw some interviews with the people who they had just gone to reform school. And the boy said things like, I didn't think a person could die so easily. This is after reform school. I didn't feel anything for the dead guy. I only thought about how to escape from the police after I'd killed him. I did not care about the victim. He looked okay to me, and then, like, you know, like he died. And then he goes to reform school, and you know, even in those sentences, he's saying, I think about what it must have been like for the parents. Like, they were really good parents. They raised this son, you know, did quite a good job on him, and then they completely lost him, and I took him away, and now I feel really guilt about it. So it's showing that he has developed this, and he's learned all of this in this reform school. And he says, oh, I think I wasn't in there long enough. I was only in there for 1 year and 2 months. I probably should have gone longer in terms of, like, punishment. But actually, he's coming out with such empathic statements that he probably didn't need longer than 1 year and 2 months because he's got it.
To remind you, nowhere in your conversation has he mentioned the influence of parents. That's where the buck stops.
Yeah.
Parents, in those instances, and Harris was the same. He had a father who was very strict. He had behavioral plans for Eric. And Eric could get around them fairly easily. He was not a parent who ignored Harris. He just was a parent who was not attuned to Harris at all. He wanted Harris to abide by his rules and regulations. And, you know, that's not how it works. When a child says to you, I should have been in the reformatory a little bit longer, what he's telling you is, my parents are useless.
That's an interesting insight, Stuart. Thank you very much. Well, Professor Twemlow, again, time flies. It goes too fast with you and us.
Love to talk to you, buddy.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you, and thank you for that, and thank you, Stephen, for being here with us.